The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, February 15th, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Happy President's Day. What better way to say Happy President's Day than to bring you one of our famous President's Day shows? Today, featuring Pulitzer Prize winner, reporter for feature writing and international reporting, David Zucchino, the New York Times, on his book, Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. This is, sorry, music went up. We are on vacation today. And it's a federal holiday, and we thought it was appropriate on a day that is not exactly Lincoln's birthday, but we celebrate Lincoln's birthday, among others. I think also George Washington's birthday. I don't know. It's President's Day. A story that you may have heard us allude to in the past on this program. During Reconstruction, which of course is that period from essentially the end of the Civil War through to the end of, you know, mid 1890s, let's say. I mean, you know, when exactly it ended, I think, you know, is maybe there's not an exact date, but it doesn't matter. This is the period where there was literal Reconstruction going on in this country from the Civil War. And there was an attempt by the radical Republicans at that time to reshape, to rebuild and restructure the country. And Andrew Johnson, of course, tried to thwart that stuff. That's why ultimately they tried to impeach him. And throughout the South, we had instances of black people voting and black people getting elected to federal office and state offices. And then, of course, we saw the pushback. And we've talked about different stories. What happened in Wilmington is a piece of history that has been buried, much of Reconstruction. And, you know, anybody who's listened to this program for even a short period of time, I think, knows that I have become a little bit, I'm not obsessed with Reconstruction, but I am quite convinced that it, when we talk about America's founding, we are really actually talking about Reconstruction. And when we talk about the missed opportunity that this country had, a second bite at the apple, a way to get it right, this era of Reconstruction was it. And it wasn't just because, well, we messed up. There was a concerted effort by wealthy white people to make sure that what was being, the seeds that were being planted during Reconstruction were never to grow into anything. And they were quite, quite successful. Just 10, 15 years after what takes place in Wilmington, you have a huge percentage, 6% of the country, card-carrying members of the KKK. You have all of these Confederate statues erected around the country. Obviously, Jim Crow comes in, like Reconstruction. Jim Crow is the pushback to that, the inhibition of people voting, disenfranchisement, all of these things that last, you know, into the 1960s, born in response to this era. So it's not just a missed opportunity. It was a purposeful attempt, a successful attempt to stop this country from being more just. I don't know how else to put it. This is a really amazing story and one that we should be far more aware of. And there are more stories like this. We'll take a quick break, do some ads, and then when we come back, I'll be talking to David Zucchino about Wilmington's Lie, the murderous coup of 1898 and the rise of white supremacy. We'll be back live for reals tomorrow. Hey, today's program, sponsored by Magic Spoon. With the new year, we're all trying to eat better, but healthy breakfast doesn't have to be boring. Magic Spoon has the amazing flavors you love, but without all the bad stuff. I cannot tell you how happy I am that I have found Magic Spoon. They have released a new variety pack. It features peanut butter. Peanut butter is one of my top three flavors that Magic Spoon has. Magic Spoon released peanut butter as a limited edition flavor in 2020. It sold out three times. Peanut butter's gotten so much love, they decided to keep it permanent and add it to the bestsellers variety pack, which also includes frosted, fruity, and cocoa. That's zero sugar, 13 to 14 grams of protein, only 4 net grams of carbs in each serving, and only 140 calories per a serving. It's keto-friendly, it's gluten-free, it's grain-free, soy-free, low-carb, and GMO-free. But for me, it tastes great. Well, I got to admit, too, I'm also super psyched about not putting sugar in my body and getting extra protein by eating a cereal I love. I'm not going to lie. Number one flavor for me, cinnamon. Number two, cocoa and peanut butter tied for second. My kids love the fruity and the frosted. They love it. And I'm excited about giving it to them. I don't have to feel bad because it's not garbage. They're eating stuff that is not full of sugar. They're getting some protein and they love it. What more could you possibly ask? Except for that they bring back the gingerbread, which was also a limited version in 2020, but I'm not going to get into that. That was also really good. That could have been like my, that would be tied for second for me too, but I'm not going to get into that. Go to magicspoon.com/majority report. You grab a variety pack and try it today. Be sure to use our promo code Majority Report at checkout. You save $5 off your order. Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. Remember, get your next delicious bowl of guilt-free cereal at magicspoon.com/majority report. Use the code Majority Report. Save $5. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode. Thank you also for sponsoring my breakfast and, frankly, sometimes my midnight snack. And also, I keep right here. Where's my cup? I nibble on it during the show occasionally. Magic Spoon. Check it out. Also, today's program sponsored by another product that I am all in on. Doesn't matter if you like to hit the snooze button or if you like to get up early. Everyone deserves to sleep in ultimate comfort. That starts with your comforter. Brooklinen can help you get your best sleep ever. Brooklinen creates beautiful, high-quality bedding and home essentials. They work directly with manufacturers, so they give you a fair price. There's no middlemen. There's no markups. Their comforters are lightweight. They're all season. They're ultra warm. You can do any one, each one of those three, I guess, or all three if you want. They suit every type of sleeper and lifestyle. For me, gotta say, I'm lightweight. I'm not a lightweight as a person. I'm a lightweight. I get hot when I sleep. There's even a weighted comforter option for stress relief. Those are actually quite good. They also offer a variety of materials. They have an eco-friendly recycled down alternative. And Brooklinen's comforters pair perfectly with their sheets, pillows, and duvet colors. There's a reason why Brooklinen has over 75,000 five-star reviews and counting. I got to tell you, I am very close to being now totally Brooklinen'd. I've done it over time, converted my pillowcases. Some of the stuff, frankly, wore out, but some of it I just didn't like. And I'm like, you know, why am I? The thing about Brooklinen is I love sleeping in the sheets, and it's not so expensive that I can't pull the trigger. I think folks know anything about me. It is I am very, very reluctant to expend any money. But I am learning that, you know what? Spend a little bit more than I would, or I would just like go and spend it for something you really like and that's going to last. And that's what's beautiful about Brooklinen. Treat yourself to the ultimate comfort with Brooklinen's comforter collection. Go to brooklinen.com. Use the promo code MajorityReport to get $25 off with a minimum purchase of $100. So $100 turns into $75. That's pretty good in terms of a cost. BROOKLINEN.com. Brooklinen. Brooklinen.com. Enter the promo code MajorityReport for $25 off with a minimum purchase of $100. That's Brooklinen.com. Promo code MajorityReport. You can go buy another pillow. Oh, and folks, this is another product I use on a regular basis, and it's great because anything that can save me time, it's worth its weight in gold as far as I'm concerned. My recommendation, you want to learn something, you don't want to dedicate more time than necessary, an app called Blinkist. It's for anybody who cares about learning but doesn't have a lot of time. Blinkist takes the key ideas and insights, condenses them down from 4,000 nonfiction bestsellers in over 27 different categories, gathers them together, puts them in 15-minute text and or audio explainers. They call them blinks. You use blinks to get into a topic quickly, or you can use it to find new topics that you want to grow from, or you can figure out which of these books warrant you reading the whole thing. Blinkist has even teamed up with the popular podcast creators to blink those for you too, so you can listen and get the key takeaways, get to the heart of a podcast episode fast. 15 million people are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge in 27 nonfiction categories like self-improvement, management, mindfulness, and more. For me, I have two categories of reasons why I use Blinkist. One is because, like, the how-to books, I'm not going to read all the prose. Sorry. I'll take away the key takeaways, though. I'll find out, like, how I can work, 4 days a week or 4 hours a week. Or how I can, you know, make friends better than I do, be more charming, be less smug. I haven't come across that yet, but. And then there are other things that I'll, feel like I should read, but I don't feel like reading. The Rachel Maddow's book, Blowout. I blanked that. I blinked it. Can you say that? Why We Sleep. I was interested in knowing that. I wasn't interested in reading the whole book by Matthew Walker, so I checked that out. It's great, and it's easy because you can either read it, or I'm a big listen-to guy. Surprise, surprise. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/MajorityReport. Start your 7-day free trial, and then you get 25% off of Blinkist Premium Membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/MajorityReport to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/MajorityReport. Now back to the show. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone, or I guess the Zoom, as it were. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Pulitzer Prize winning reporter David Scicchino, who is a contributing writer to the New York Times. On his most recent book, Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. David, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Sam.
I can't tell you, like, I mean, I should just full disclosure up front. I have been the past a couple of years, the Reconstruction era has become for me a central means of understanding, particularly this era, but also the country. I am of the belief that it really was sort of the functional equivalent of our genuine founding of this country in many respects, as it's lived today, I guess. Your book is so important in terms of describing that era and the end of that era and how defining it has been for what we're going through today. So give us a sense. This is about, obviously, the lie is about the massacre that took place in Wilmington in 1898. In November of that year. Give us a sense of what Wilmington was like. I guess we're talking really basically the end of the Civil War up until the 1890s. What was Wilmington like? What it had become?
Yeah, Wilmington was really an outlier in the South at that time. There really wasn't another major Southern city that was anything like Wilmington. First of all, it was a Black majority city, 56% Black, but more importantly, it had a multiracial government, and that was a pretty rare thing so far after Reconstruction. Wilmington had a city council that had three of its 10 members were Black. 10 of their 26 policemen were Black. There were Black magistrates. The county treasurer and the county coroner were Black men. Blacks were just embedded in local government. There was also a thriving Black middle class, bigger and probably more dominant than in most Southern cities or any other Southern city. And there were more than 60 Black professionals. These are doctors and lawyers and teachers who lived upper middle class lives. And that was pretty unusual in the South at that time. And for all those reasons, the white supremacists, who were a minority in the population, just couldn't tolerate that because they had been in power, obviously, up through the Civil War. And then after Reconstruction, and they had lost power in the early 1890s when Black voters, Black men had the vote since 1868 in North Carolina, aligned themselves with disgruntled white populists who had grown pretty tired of the Democratic Party, which was the party of white supremacy at the time, because they had embraced banks and railroads and big business, and the white populace felt disenfranchised. So they joined with white Republicans and Black Republicans to take over the city government and the state legislature in North Carolina in the early 1890s, after white supremacists, since the end of Reconstruction, had controlled everything. So this just really all came to a head in 1898, which was a midterm election year.
Okay, and so I want to back up a little bit here. That populist party was, I think, the People's Party at the time, and I mean, this is what is fascinating to me about you know, Wilmington in particular, is that sort of like delay, right? Because this is late, like you say, in Reconstruction. And we already had massacres in Vicksburg, Mississippi at this point. We had in Charleston, South Carolina, and around South Carolina, a similar dynamic that was going on here. That was, in fact, in the past couple of weeks, I interviewed someone who talked about the development of the concept of taxpayers that was developed by former plantation owners who were looking to unseat the political power of Black people in South Carolina, could not motivate the Appalachian whites who weren't interested in voting against their own interests just because they were Black people. And they developed this idea of taxpayer revolt because, of course, all the expenditures that were involved in Reconstruction, literally the Reconstruction. it's fascinating to me that it is that this was like how much power and political power, but almost financially, too, did these folks that we're talking about, these white Democrats, these white supremacists, lose when the People's Party fused with the Black Republican power base there? Like, was there material losses? Was it political power? Was it what was it that was, or what were the factors, I guess, that were driving their need at this point to react?
Yeah, it was political power and control. I mean, the Black vote was really an existential threat, particularly in North Carolina. There were 18 Eastern counties, including the one that included Wilmington, that had Black majorities. So if all the Black people voted, the whites would never get back into power. And we see that reflected today in the Republican Party and in voter suppression. But this was really part of the whole Redeemer movement in the South, not just in North Carolina, but across the South, where white supremacists rose up after the withdrawal of federal troops, Union troops, after 1877, and basically through violence, through the KKK, took that power back, and then they lost it. They lost the poor white vote. This was what happened in North Carolina. When the poor whites went the other way, that's what really prompted what the white supremacists themselves called their white supremacy campaign in North Carolina in 1898. It was certainly aimed at robbing Black men of the right to vote and the right to hold public office, but it was also a part of a disinformation campaign to convince those poor white voters that Blacks were a direct threat to their not only economic prosperity, but to their political participation. And they pounded that message and they played on white racist fears, particularly sexual insecurities. There was a disinformation campaign about what the white supremacists called the Black Beast Rapist. And the newspapers just pounded away all summer and fall in 1898 that Black men were, there was a rape epidemic by Black men against white women. It was completely false. There was no epidemic at all, but that Black men were beasts who were preying on white women. And at the same time, these white voters were told that Blacks were inferior. They weren't intelligent enough to vote, that their white race traitors, the Republicans, were using them cynically to keep the Republicans in power. And secondly, that Black men who were in power were completely corrupt and incompetent and had no right to hold any political power. So when you have this message pounded away, it turned those whites against the Blacks, and it helped the Democrats basically steal the 1898 midterm election, which was carried out 2 days before the coup in Wilmington.
Let's go back a little bit. Tell us, let's start with, you know, during this, your book itself is in three different parts. And the first being the sort of the, broadly speaking, the rejection of Reconstruction and this idea that that you had white former plantation owners, et cetera, of that class lose both the political power and essentially on some level, you know, their economic power, or at least these were threatened. Tell us about Alfred Waddell, the colonel.
Yeah, Colonel Alfred Moore Waddell was a failed Confederate officer. He lasted just a few months in the war, but he had been a colonel and lost his command when he got sick and went home to Wilmington. And then he had served in Congress representing Wilmington, and was defeated by the Republican who became the governor of North Carolina at the time of the coup. And he was a very Trumpian figure. He charged that election had been stolen from him. He was a very accomplished and skillful orator, and he knew, just like Trump, how to play on white fears and grievances and really, really incite white men, particularly poor white men, not only to vote against the Democrats, but to rise up and attack Blacks. And over the period of several weeks and months, he basically incited these whites to rise up and kill Black men on the day of the coup. I mean, the coup was announced well beforehand. It was well planned.
Yeah, I want to get to that. That's the thing that it struck me was just sort of, and we'll get to, I think it was the Congressman White, who had basically given, you know, advance warning to the president that this was happening. I mean, that just the slow motionness of all of that. But I want to get that sense of, like, you know, where we were. I mean, I'm still fascinated by those 10 years or so in the 80s. As you're leading up to that, you know, from the 80s into the 90s, where, you know, there's just some type of like stasis on some level. And I assume the resent is building, but the nature of that, of what's driving that, really sort of fascinates me, that era leading up. And so, you know, the rejection of Reconstruction, the different building blocks of how much of it is racism, how much of it is racism mixed in with loss of economic power, how much of it is racism that is developed in service of protecting economic power, and how those, you know, it's obviously tough to tease that out, I guess, in retrospect, and probably even in contemporaneously. But I'm curious on your perspective of that.
Yeah, it was pure racism. The whites had lost some economic power when obviously they lost the free labor they'd enjoyed all those years through slavery on their plantations, but they were still dominant economically as far as the big industries of the day, which were cotton, railroads, and the naval stores industries, all dominated by whites who did hire blacks at very low wages. So it really wasn't economic. It was about pure political power and making sure that black men no longer voted or held public office. And now in the 80s was really the rise of the Klan. That was the heyday of the KKK. And their really focus was on preventing black men from not only voting, but registering to vote. And they were extremely successful at that and gradually turned the tide. And it ultimately, after 1898, kept blacks from voting and kept them out of public office. They were extremely successful at that, but it began in the 80s during the so-called Redeemer Movement.
The one of the facts that stood out to me was in 1896, 25,000 black registered voters. In 1902, this is in Wilmington,
right?
6,000.
Yeah.
That's nuts. I mean, get to that part.
It was actually worse than that. It was 126,000 black voters in the state in 1896. And then by 1902, it was 6,000.
Oh, wow. I must have, my notes are.
Yeah.
Are
that was statewide. Still. Yeah.
All right. Well, I want to just go back again to that one period. Abraham Galloway, tell us about him.
Fascinating character. There should be statues to him, and there actually is a movement to put up some statues in Wilmington. Abraham Galloway was an escaped slave. He stowed away on a ship from Wilmington and got to Philadelphia and became a spy for the Union Army. He went behind the lines and spied on the Confederacy and reported back to Union officers. But more importantly, he was absolutely key to raising the so-called colored regiments in North Carolina in 1863. There were none. And he single-handedly almost convinced and persuaded thousands of freed slaves, newly freed slaves, or so-called contrabands, the ones who escaped the plantations and had been freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, to join these colored regiments and serve in the war. So he was an important figure. And after the war, he was the first black man to serve as a state senator in North Carolina. And he was central in 1868 to the convention where at the time Southern states were forced to rewrite their constitutions under Reconstruction. And he led the fight for black voting rights and black civil rights and got them in 1868 for black men in North Carolina.
So and he was from Wilmington. As we move forward, and we get into this sort of where I guess the, I don't want to say the worm turns at this point, but on some level, as it's turning, Tell us about I guess he's the editor or the publisher of the New Observer, Josephus Davies, is it?
Yeah, Josephus Daniels. Yeah, was the publisher and editor of the News and Observer in Raleigh, a paper that still exists today, and at that time was the most powerful newspaper in the state and was really the only media. They were king of media because obviously there was no internet, and no social media, no radio and TV. People got their news from the newspaper, and this was the dominant paper in the state. He was also the head of the executive committee for the Democratic Party. So he was essentially a politician who owned the state's biggest newspaper and the biggest mouthpiece. And he was a masterful propagandist, and he was in charge of the white supremacy campaign's propaganda campaign that summer to lure back the white voters and to just incite white violence against black men leading up to the election to keep them from voting in the election. And then after the election, to kill black men in the streets and drive out thousands of blacks from Wilmington as part of the coup. It was not possible. It would not have been possible without Josephus Daniels. At the same time, just to show you how clever he was and what a great propagandist he was, he realized that 25% of white voters in North Carolina were illiterate. And so in order to get the white supremacist men to them, he hired a political cartoonist to draw these just awful cartoons, some of which are reprinted in the book, depicting black men as savages, apes, thugs, who were basically literally reaching out these hairy claws to grasp at Southern white women with their boots on white men's backs, just really, really incited whites with these really overtly racist images. Between that and the big lie that was told every day in the newspapers that black men were sexual beasts and that they were incompetent and incapable of voting and holding public office, it just created this fever pitch by election day and by the day of the coup, where white men were ready to go out and kill, and they did go out and kill.
We will get to that, but I want to also tell us a little bit about Furnifold Simmons, which
love that name,
like a fictional name. But
yeah, it doesn't sound like a real character.
We need a really Southern. We need a name that would have been one I would have landed on, maybe.
Yeah, he was the other one of the big conspirators in the white supremacy campaign. He was chairman of the Democratic Party, and he really organized these white men clubs around the state and organized basically the terrorist arm of the white supremacy movement, which were the red shirts. These were vigilantes, and under Simmons' direction and the direction of some of the other leaders of the white supremacy campaign, they went out through the countryside around Wilmington and yanked black men out of their beds at night, pulled them out, threatened them, whipped them, beat them, and told them if they dared register to vote, they would come back and kill them. And they just pounded away at this all summer and just terrified black men. And Furnifold Simmons at the same time was organizing a speaker's campaign where he had really skillful speakers. The best one was Colonel Waddell, who we mentioned earlier, but there were others who would go out on the stump. The N-word was used just liberally in these speeches and in newspapers. It was in print, in editorials, and in news columns, very commonly used. These men would just rile up with the help of the red shirts at these rallies and have these white men just foaming at the mouth, ready to go out and kill black people. And this went on over the summer and fall leading up to the election and coup. And Furnifold Simmons was one of the leaders of that effort.
All right. So tell us what that midterm election was that was taking place that ended up being just days before the coup. But what was that election specifically for?
Yeah, that was the midterm election. It was for members of Congress from the state. It was for the state legislature, and it was for county offices, but it was not for municipal offices. The city council, the mayor, the police chief, the county sheriff, none of those were up for re-election until the next March. So that's why even after they stole the election on election day, they still needed to remove the city government where you had all these black officials in power. So
what was the relationship? I mean, if they couldn't essentially disenfranchise enough black voters that they could get rid of the elected officials in the city itself, because that was not what the elections for, why was it tied to the elections? Was it just simply because it provided them a sort of a fig leaf to maintain this campaign, or was it just a twofer? I mean, why was it, but I mean, why right. was it, why was it tied? Because it feels like it was tied to the midterm
Absolutely.
Elections, even
yeah.
though they couldn't get the benefit that they wanted from material election from those
yeah.
elections.
Yeah. It was a tool to incite white rage, and it just melded perfectly into the coup. They really needed to use the election as a way to just mount this propaganda campaign. In absence of election, it would have been difficult. Voters were really not paying attention, but they were paying very close attention, and they needed to take over the state government, the state legislature. Which was also run, was a Republican-dominated legislature, and there were black members of the legislature, and they needed to do that. And from that base of power, 2 days later, then it was no problem to mount this coup and kill up to 60 black men, more than 60 black men, and run out all the leading blacks who they didn't murder, and the white Republicans. They were as angry at the white Republicans as they were as the blacks, because they considered them race traitors. They even sent out these postcards and handbills that were put all over town saying, "Remember the six." And these were the six leading white Republicans that they targeted and banished from the city the day of the coup.
Yeah, that's the nine group six. Is that?
They were two secret groups. It was almost comical the way this white supremacy campaign worked. They had these names, the group six and the secret nine. And a lot of times they didn't know what the other group was doing, because they tried to keep it so secret. At the same time, they announced to the world that they were going to, first of all, win the election by the ballot or the bullet or both, and they were going to use violence if necessary. And secondly, they announced that they were going to overthrow the government in Wilmington. And both of those things were very, very public, which is, it just seems amazing to us.
Well, that's what I was just about to ask you. Like, there was a massive public wind up to this. And during the months leading up to the election, when you did have those situations where they sent the red shirts out, why was there no, I mean, if these people did not have control of the city government, why was there no, like, where were the police, or what, you know, where were the officials? Like, what was the theory as to why there was no confrontation prior to this?
Yes. Well, the black population, as you can imagine, was terrorized. And what's important is during this whole summer and fall, whites were buying up guns just like they are today. They armed themselves to the teeth with Winchesters and shotguns and pistols and ammunition, and they sold out all the guns and ammo in Wilmington, and they had to call out for extra guns and ammo to Richmond and Baltimore and have it brought in by train. But at the same time, all the gun stores were controlled by white supremacists, and they refused to sell any weapons to blacks. So here you have this black majority that's completely outgunned. They don't have any weapons. At the same time, you've got this enraged white citizenry and the red shirts armed to the teeth. And at the same time, they also had two state militias in Wilmington that were supposed to answer to the Republican governor, but were in fact commanded by white supremacists, the leaders of the white supremacy campaign, and made up entirely of white supremacists. And they were brought out on the day of the coup to go through the streets and search for black men to kill. And they had been supplied with two machine guns by the city's white merchants to help them on the day of the coup to completely overwhelm and terrorize the Black community. So that's one reason why there wasn't any opposition. The Blacks were terrified. And the white leadership, the white Republicans, were just demonized in the media with things like this. Remember the six billboards and postcards that went out, and they were completely intimidated. And so was the Republican governor, Daniel Russell. He was from Wilmington, and he was part of the Rice gentry. His father had been a slave owner. He was of the same class as all the leaders of the white supremacy movement in Wilmington. He was related to some by marriage. They were his former friends. They knew how to play on his fears, and they threatened to assassinate him and to impeach him. He completely rolled over. And he would have been the one guy who could have put a stop to this.
Right.
Could have really fought against this, but he was in fear of his life. He was advised on election day not to go home to Wilmington to vote, but he said, oh no, I've got to go there. It's my hometown. He barely escaped with his life. The red shirts made several attempts to lynch him, and he had this harrowing train ride back to Raleigh, where at every stop, the red shirts were out there drunk and with their guns, tried to get on the train. And he just by the grace of God got out of there and made it back to the governor's mansion in Raleigh, where there was another almost a riot of red shirts and other enraged white citizens to meet him there, and he barely got inside the governor's mansion.
So if I understand it, you know, in the months leading up to this election, there is a sense amongst the Black population and presumably amongst the white Republican population that let's not touch this hornet's nest because they literally have us outgunned. The appeals to any agency outside of Wilmington, presumably like the state government and the militia, are either completely feckless and in fear or frankly working for the other side. During this time, if I'm not mistaken, over the summer, you had the one African-American congressman, George Henry White, actually goes and meets with President McKinley. And what does he say?
Yes. Now, George Henry White was the only Black man in Congress, in the Senate or the House. He was the only one. And he was from a district right next to Wilmington. He went to the White House a few weeks before the coup, told McKinley, there's this white supremacy campaign. You've read about it in the papers. These guys are serious. They are going to do it. They've announced it. You've got to send federal troops in to protect Black voters. You have, you know, you're authorized. You have the authority to do it. You need, and what's interesting is McKinley was an abolitionist. He had been a union officer. He had used Black votes to put him into office, and he had appealed to Black votes. So he basically owed Black men, Black voters, his position. He absolutely refused to do anything about it. He was completely, I think he was intimidated by the white supremacists, not only in North Carolina, but throughout the South. And he needed them. He was coming up for re-election in 1900. He needed those white votes. And I think he anticipated that this insurrection in North Carolina was going to be successful and that Black people might not even be voting by 1900, which turned out to be the case. So I think he made a political calculation. I'm just going to stay out of it. He was also visited by a number of Black ministers, prominent Black ministers in Washington, who went to see him and told him the same thing. Said, you've got to send federal troops. You've got to protect the 13th, 14th, and 15th amendments to the Constitution. And you've got to protect Black men's right to vote. And he refused to do it. And he never said why. He never said one public word about the coup before or after. Never mentioned it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that coup, because on election day, how did at that point we have or we the these Democrats, essentially these white supremacists, have effectively diminished the voting population.
Correct.
And so to the extent that you can say this, they won the elections, though they weren't directly involved in Wilmington. So what, like, what,
what brought about the 2 days later? Like, what was there an incitement there, or was it just simply that was always the plan? We're going to do this 2 days after the election, because we're talking about a mass slaughter of people and a dispossession, I guess you could say. Basically, you know, you get out of town. And so, like, why 2 days later, and then start to tell us some of the details of it? I mean, it's horrific. It is completely, we should say, coordinated, right? I mean, this is not random, somebody going down to the town square and shooting. They're targeting specific individuals.
Oh, it's premeditated. Yes. Yeah. They were saying all summer, we're going to win by the ballot or the bullet or both. So they had planned to steal the election with violence. They announced that and they did it. But the, as I mentioned before, we still got this problem that the city municipal government is still in power. So they said, let's give ourselves a couple of days. 2 days should be enough. And they called it of watching and waiting. But from this new seat of political power, then we can easily rise up. We've already got all these white men just enraged and incited, and we can light the match anytime we want. And that's the day we're going to do it. The Republicans will be completely disorganized. They lost the election. They're terrified of us. Blacks won't put up any resistance. They don't have any weapons, and they've been completely intimidated. So that's our day. They announced it, and they pulled it off. What's interesting is Waddell at a meeting the night before the election. It was a meeting of red shirts. It was this raucous rally. And 2 weeks before, he had told the red shirts to choke the Cape Fear River with black carcasses. On this night, he went even further. He said, if you see the black man out voting tomorrow, tell him to stop, sending him home. If he doesn't stop, shoot him down. Shoot him down in their tracks. He actually told them to murder any black man who tried to vote. And on election day, they went out, the red shirts and other armed whites went out to the city. Anytime they saw a black man, they either beat him or threatened him or intimidated him and sent him home. At the same time, the red shirts swamped all the precincts. They would just jump into the precinct while the votes were being counted, overwhelm vote officials. They would take all the Republican ballots and replace them with Democratic ballots. It was literal ballot stuffing. So they stole the election. They won, the quote, won easily. And then, as I say, then 2 days later came the riot. The riot and the coup.
So what happens, like, what happens to the elected officials in the city? Like, when you say a coup, like, okay, we have black police chief. We have black city councilmen. We have are they basically just told, like, resign right now or die, and then they just walk away? I mean, walk us through that process.
Well, that was well thought out and well timed. First of all, they wanted to go out and kill as many blacks as they could. So the riot begins when Waddell leads about almost 2,000 white men, red shirts and armed white vigilantes and just regular citizens, including clergymen and lawyers out there with their Winchesters. He leads them to the black newspaper. There was a black daily, a very rare thing in the South at that time.
Published by Alex Manley.
Alex Manley, another incredible figure. He was the grandson of a white governor. I've talked to his relatives today and said, well, he could have passed for white easily. If you see photos of him, he looks white, but he refused to pass. He lived his life as a proud black man. And he was this very courageous editor who challenged white supremacy day after day in the newspaper, wrote an incendiary editorial that summer that just about got him lynched. But on the morning of the coup, they marched to the paper. It had already shut down the day before because they knew what was happening. And Manley barely got out of the city alive ahead of a lynch mob, burned the paper down, and then just started the red shirts and all these armed white citizens coursed through the streets looking for black men to kill, and ended up killing more than 60, just shot them dead in the streets with the help of the two state militias who brought out their machine guns. So it was basically a slaughter by white terrorists. By late afternoon, you can imagine the effect that this must have had on the city council, which was with three black men and seven Republican populists, all white men. The mob led by Waddell marches to City Hall, confronts the city council, the mayor, and the police chief at gunpoint, and said, "You guys are going to resign." And as you can imagine, it didn't take much to persuade these guys. They all resigned at gunpoint. And amazingly, the mob, quote, elected the leaders of the mob as mayor, city council members, and police chief, and Waddell became the mayor.
And that was not what we would call, I guess, a general election.
It was not. It was an election by a mob.
And many of these people were essentially driven out of Wilmington and told, you're not coming back. I think, was it Manley who was trying to come back for his grandmother? Was it?
No, it was George C. Miller who was
George Miller, right?
The richest black man in Wilmington. The white supremacists had what they officially called a banishment campaign, and this was aimed at the black men they didn't kill and all the white leaders. They didn't kill any white men, but they had a list of the most influential black and white political leaders in the city, and they were to be banished. What's interesting is they left out any federal employee. There was black man who was the collector of customs at the Wilmington port, who made $4,000 a year, incredible salary. It was $1,000 more than the governor made. They left him completely alone. He had been appointed by McKinley. He was a federal employee, and they knew if they had killed or assaulted a federal employee, then McKinley would be under great pressure to send in troops. So they left all federal employees, white or black, alone. But they came up with this list of all the other black and white leaders and put them in jail the evening of the riot. And the next morning, the militias marched them to the train station and put them on the train. And the white supremacists said, "Leave town. Don't ever come back. If you do, we will shoot you on sight." Not one of those guys ever came back. Not one of them.
So I don't know how to phrase this. Has Wilmington ever recovered, I mean, in this respect, or has has black representation, black wealth, black power even come close to recovering relative to where they were and relative to where they were in that time, 120 years later?
No, they were completely devastated. The black middle class has never recovered, not even close. The black professional class has not recovered. I was going to give you a population figure. Oh, it was 56%, as I mentioned, 56% black in 1898. Today it's 18% black. And Wilmington is very well known as a place that is not welcoming to black people, and no black person in their right mind would want to move there and live there and raise their families. The black middle class is very small now. After George Henry White was forced out of office by Josephus Daniels at the News and Observer, had this campaign where he used the N-word over and over again and drove him out of the state. He left the state and went to New Jersey. After that, in 1900,
this was the congressman, the only congressman
there,
elected.
There was no black citizen elected to the U.S. Congress until 1992, almost 100 years later. At the same time, after 1898, you gave the figures earlier, basically black people did not vote in any significant numbers in North Carolina and basically throughout the South. Until passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. This is, almost 70 years later before blacks started voting again. So this was incredibly successful. After those three black city councilmen were run out of office during the coup and run out of town in 1898, no black person served on the city council until 1972. That was almost 75 years later.
There's so many lessons I feel like that people can learn from a story like this, right? And including the durability of racism and racist events. And I mean, this is, in some respects, it's astonishing how what happened that day and the buildup to it and all the forces, how that ripples through history.
Right.
What does it say also that I went through the vast majority of my fairly long life. I'm well into middle age, and never heard of this. And like, I mean, like, what were the forces that A, keep this out of our history? And it's not just true of the Wilmington massacre. It's true of the Vicksburg one. It's true of what took place in Charlotte. I mean, it's all part of like a whole, just a massive disinformation campaign or misinformation campaign that goes from, you know, the lost cause and through this, like, I mean, well, like, how did that happen that we don't have that? Let's put it this way. How did it happen that you had this opportunity to write this book so much longer, you know, after it happened?
Yeah. Well, a lie, a big lie told well and often is a powerful thing. And that's what this was. It was a big lie. This lie that, first of all, that blacks were planning a riot. That was the pretext. The blacks were planning this riot. They're raping white women. They're incapable of running a government. And so, unfortunately, we had to rise up and take matters into our own hands and get a competent government there, ruled as it should be by white men. And this was the story that was told for almost 100 years in Wilmington. And that's why nobody ever heard about it. I didn't hear about it until 1998. And I went to high school and college in North Carolina and never learned about this. In 1998, the city of Wilmington had a centennial, and the university there basically tried to bring blacks and whites, and particularly the descendants of people on both sides, together and have a reconciliation and really confront their history and tell the true story of what really happened. And that's when I learned about it, by reading about this in the newspapers. But they were extremely effective in framing the story, in framing the narrative, and they did it through disinformation and the big lie. And when I saw those Confederate flags in the Capitol the other day during that insurrection, I said, we have seen this before. There were so many parallels between what happened in 1898 and at the Capitol. First of all, it was the disinformation campaign by a demagogue just spouting these crazy theories about a stolen election, not only a stolen election, but a stolen birthright. In 1898, whites were told that your birthright's been stolen from you by these black men. You have the inherent right, we do, to rule over this inferior race, and they've taken it away. And Trump told his followers that your country's being taken from you. They have robbed it from them. They've not only stolen the election, they've stolen your country from you. And what I found really significant, and when he spent that 2 months talking about the stolen election, he kept focusing on voter fraud, alleged voter fraud in the black precincts in Philadelphia, Detroit, and Atlanta. He hammered away at that. And that, the subtext there, and it's not too subtle, is these black people are voting illegally. They are in charge of this election fraud, and they took your country away from you. And if you remember, even when he won the election in 2016, he said all along that it was going to be rigged. He said afterwards it was rigged, that 6 million illegal immigrants voted. So he is telling his followers that your country is stolen from you by black and brown people and immigrants, and go and take it back. And I really think that was a big motivation for the incitement during the Capitol riot. I really think it was a big part of it.
It's fascinating, because I know you also, one of the books you wrote was about the welfare queen myth, mm-hmm. which was at the very least promoted by Ronald Reagan, if not generated by him. And I think everyone hopefully listening to this program is aware that Ronald Reagan kicked off his general election in 1980 in near the Neshoba County Fair in Philadelphia, Mississippi, which was the site of three civil rights workers getting murdered, and talked about states' rights, which was a euphemism. I mean, when you look at this and we see these parallels between what just happened, on some level, I think, you know, particularly in the context of race, which is in my mind sort of one of the defining, if not the defining elements of American politics in many respects, and the way that it interplays, obviously, with a wealthy elite, because it is so often deployed in service of people who have controlled the resources. How do you view history? I mean, like, in the sense that it is, you know, it's one thing to say like there's a parallel here, but it's also there's a trajectory. And it's almost like, you know, if I have a limp at the beginning of a walk and then, you know, a mile down, I still have a limp. It's not that these two moments reflect each other. It's that they're connected in some way.
Yeah. Well, what really shocked me about Donald Trump's win in 2016 was how it exposed this undercurrent of white resentment and white hate, white victimization at the hands of black and brown people. And it had been there all along, and I hadn't quite realized how deep it was and just how strong and pervasive it was. It goes all the way back to the Civil War and Reconstruction and to Wilmington and all these other places that we've mentioned, and it never went away. And I foolishly believed, like a lot of Americans, well, we've had our black president for two terms and we're post-racial now, and we finally solved all those problems. And Donald Trump is a genius at inciting and playing on these deep-seated white fears and hatreds and grievances and really inciting people to action. And in 2016, it was to come out and vote. And on January 6th, it was to go and storm the Capitol and lynch Mike Pence. This is pretty frightening that you have this strong undercurrent so long after Reconstruction and the Civil War, and it's still there, and how easy it is for a demagogue to ignite it. And we're not done with this, by the way. I don't think so. I think we're going to see more of this, you know, whether Trump's president or not.
David Zucchino, the book is Wilmington's Lie, The Murderous Coup of 1898 and the Rise of White Supremacy. We'll put a link, obviously, to your book at majority.fm. Thank you so much for your time today. I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. It was great talking to you.